Usually when someone stands up to deliver a presentation, there's this, well, this split second right before they even open their mouth where you can feel exactly how it's going to go.
The energy in the room completely shifts.
Right. You just instinctively know if you're about to hear a captivating story or if you're about to suffer through like a grueling data dump.
We have all been trapped in that room, with the data dumper.
The absolute worst.
You sit there watching them fire up a slide deck with bullet points so tiny you can't even read them, and your brain just preemptively shuts down.
It's self-defense at that point. But today, we are making sure you are never that person again. We are going to reverse engineer the absolute mechanics of elite storytelling.
And we're doing that by looking at a really fascinating lecture from Dr. Stephen Mathewson. It's called Preaching Old Testament Narratives: Storytelling Entering and Exiting.
Now, I know what you might be thinking. The source is geared toward preachers handling ancient texts, but don't let that fool you.
No, not at all.
The mechanics he outlines here are really a masterclass in human communication. Whether you are prepping for a boardroom pitch or, trying to catch your team up on a complex quarterly report.
Or honestly, just wanting to tell better stories at a dinner party.
Exactly. This deep dive is going to show you how to take a dry outline, a basic skeleton, and make it actually live and breathe.
The translation from ancient text to the modern boardroom is incredibly direct. I mean, if you think about it, Mathewson is dealing with some of the most sparse, bare bones narratives in human history.
Right.
So to make those engaging, he really had to figure out how the human brain actually processes information.
And what he found is that before you can thrill an audience with a story, you have to completely rethink your preparation process, right? You need a blueprint.
Yeah, but he advocates for a blueprint that honestly most people actively avoid because it feels so counterintuitive.
Okay, let's unpack this because he is talking about the word-for-word manuscript. He argues that an outline, just jotting down your main bullet points, is completely insufficient. It's just a skeleton without any flesh.
Right. If you want a story to be attractive rather than bland, you must sit down and write out every single word you plan to say.
Which sounds exhausting. But he mentions that even after 40 years in professional speaking, he recently spent an entire 18-month cycle writing out full manuscripts.
Just for the practice of thinking deeply. But there is a really vital distinction here, though. You do not take that manuscript to the podium,
Right.
and you absolutely do not memorize it. You read it Friday and Saturday night just to internalize the phrasing.
Which feels like a paradox, I mean. Why go through the agony of writing a 10-page document if you are just going to leave it sitting on your desk?
It does seem crazy.
But it reminds me of a jazz musician. Like, a musician will intensely study sheet music all week, obsessing over the chord progressions in the theory.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right. But when they walk out on stage, they leave the music behind. They can improvise brilliantly because the structure is so deeply embedded in their bones.
Exactly.
But if I can push back on this for a second, doesn't writing a word-for-word manuscript risk making you sound, I don't know, incredibly robotic? Like, more scripted, not less.
Well, that fear of sounding scripted is exactly why so many people rely on bullet points. But here is the cognitive reality of why manuscripting actually works.
Okay.
Writing is fundamentally a way of thinking. When you agonize over your word choices on a piece of paper in a quiet room, you are forcing your brain to organize its logic.
So you're doing the heavy lifting in advance.
Yes. When you just use an outline, you are essentially demanding that your brain invent the structure, find the vocabulary, and monitor the audience's reaction all at the exact same time.
This is way too much cognitive load.
It is. The manuscript eliminates the vocabulary panic so you can just focus on connection.
But the key is really how you write that manuscript, right?
Yeah.
Mathewson emphasizes that you have to write in an oral style.
Yes, you are writing for the ear, not the eye.
Right. So you have to imagine someone with a laptop, or like an AI, transcribing you live as you speak, which means incomplete sentences are highly encouraged.
Because that is how human beings actually communicate.
Exactly. He points out that if a strict English professor wouldn't fail your manuscript, you are probably doing it wrong.
Writing for the eye is all about creating these complex, nested clauses that a reader can slow down and parse at their own speed.
Right, but writing for the ear means punchy, rhythmic bursts of thought. You have to give the listener's brain time to digest the information before you hit them with the next point. So we have the blueprint. We are writing to speak, organizing our logic on paper. But what exactly goes into this manuscript?
Well, that's the challenge, right? Because ancient stories, particularly Old Testament narratives, are famously lean.
Yeah, bare bones.
There are virtually no throwaway lines. Every detail serves a massive purpose, which means the modern storyteller has to fill in the gaps for the audience.
Without going completely overboard into, you know, fan fiction.
Right. Finding that Goldilocks zone of detail is where the true craft lies. You have to strike a balance between economy and vividness.
Avoiding that flowery elegance in favor of simplicity.
Yeah. Mathewson actually recommends studying authors like Ernest Hemingway to understand the power of stark, economical style, and strong verbs.
But at the same time, you have to give the listener enough sensory data to put them in the scene. He points to Eugene Peterson's book, Earthy Spirituality, as a perfect model for this.
Oh, the cave example.
Yes. Peterson describes the story of David hiding from King Saul in the En-Gedi cave. And instead of a flowery description of the Middle Eastern landscape, Peterson focuses purely on physical contrasts.
The hot, blinding glare of the desert sun pressing down against the cool, damp, dark of the cave.
Right. He focuses on the shadow falling across the mouth of the cave and points out the reality that Saul's eyes hadn't adjusted to the dark yet.
So he literally couldn't see David's men lurking in the recesses.
And he frames the entire entrance with this stark, almost uncomfortably grounded reality. That the king was just stepping inside to answer the call of nature.
It puts you right there in the dirt and the heat. It's brilliant.
It really is. But then Mathewson brings up these other examples that go much further. Like Peterson describes David's brother Shammah as a mincing little sophisticate in Calvin Klein jeans and alligator cowboy boots.
Right, trying to avoid stepping in cow flop.
Yeah. Or the writer Frederick Buchner, who describes the tax collector Zacchaeus as a sawed-off little social disaster.
Buchner also has this incredible description of the Syrian general Naaman. Naaman is a five-star general who expects the Jordan River to be this majestic body of water.
He realizes it looks like a muddy cow track.
Exactly. Yet when he washes in it, Buchner says he emerges looking like a palm olive soap ad. And then he tries to tip the prophet Elisha, who refuses because he's a prophet, not a dermatologist.
Okay, wait, hang on. Palmolive soap in the ancient Middle East. Yeah. Calvin Klein jeans.
I know, it sounds crazy.
If I'm giving a presentation or even just telling a story from Friends, where's the line? Doesn't throwing in massive historical anachronisms like that make me lose credibility? It feels like rewriting history for a cheap laugh.
This raises an important question, and it is a massive risk if you do it poorly. But Mathewson has a very strict boundary for this.
Which is?
Humor and modern colloquial imagery can be highly effective, but they absolutely must be constrained by exegesis.
Meaning the actual historical meaning of the text.
Right. Exegesis is just the academic term for pulling the historical reality out of the text. The historical reality has to anchor the joke.
So Shammah wasn't literally wearing Calvin Klein jeans, obviously. But the historical text tells us something specific about his unsuitability for the rugged nature of kingship.
Exactly. The modern imagery is just a translation of that historical truth. You aren't changing the facts. You are finding a modern equivalent for the vibe. You are translating the character's essence into a visual language the modern listener instantly grasps. But if you overdo the humor or invent personality traits just to land a punchline, you ruin the gravity of the story.
Because the audience can subconsciously tell when you've stopped serving the narrative and started serving your own ego as a comedian.
Oh, absolutely.
So to make sure you don't cross that line into cheap gimmicks, the manuscript has to act like a surgeon's scalpel at the sentence level.
This is where we get into the absolute non-negotiables of elite communication.
It really all comes down to specific word choices and stripping away lazy language, like use concrete words.
Yes, concrete nouns and active verbs. If a character is sneaking up on someone, don't write that they went to the front of the cave. Write that they crept.
Use boulder instead of big rock. Use stench instead of unpleasant smell and slugged instead of hit.
Right. Mathewson admits he once spent 10 minutes researching the exact wildflowers that bloomed in the Valley of Elah.
Figuring out if there were daisies or lilies, right?
Just so he could use one accurate, concrete word rather than saying, there were flowers.
That dedication to precision is what builds trust with an audience. But the flip side of using strong nouns and verbs is eliminating the crutches we use to prop up weak sentences.
Oh, the modifiers. Mathewson quotes the poet Carl Sandburg, who said, I am more suspicious of adjectives than at any other time in all my born days.
Words like fine, bad, good, nice, or big. They are incredibly lazy.
They are lazy because they tell the listener how to feel rather than making them feel it.
It's kind of like, okay, adjectives and passive verbs are like adding MSG or, you know, too much maple syrup to pancakes.
Oh, I like that.
Like, a tiny bit might enhance the flavor, but if you rely on it to pick up the slack of weak cooking, the whole dish becomes sickeningly sweet.
That is so true. And the ultimate destroyer of momentum in any presentation is the passive voice. Mathewson is absolutely ruthless about this.
You cannot say Goliath's forehead was struck by a stone that had been hurled.
No, you have to say David hurled a stone and struck Goliath's forehead.
But why does that matter so much? I mean, both sentences convey the exact same factual information.
It comes down to the cognitive friction the passive voice creates in the brain. When you use passive voice, you are forcing the listener's mind to work backward.
Oh, interesting.
If you say, the ball was thrown by John, the brain has to picture a ball, suspend it in midair, and hold that image in a state of unresolved tension until it finally hears who threw it.
That sounds exhausting for the listener.
It takes mental energy to assemble the scene. When you say John threw the ball, the actor, the action, and the object flow in the exact sequence, the brain naturally processes physical reality.
Active verbs propel the listener forward without friction. He actually suggests a brilliant modern hack to enforce this, too.
The AI editor.
Yeah. Feed your manuscript to an AI and prompt it to point out any passive verbs or instances of the word there.
Right, because instead of saying there was something ironic about his instructions, you change it to his instructions dripped with irony.
It's such a simple fix.
Hmm.
But he also warns against overcorrecting.
Right. Yeah, don't be too clever. Don't try to oversensationalize basic dialogue. You don't need to read that a character bellowed when a simple shouted gets the job done.
Show, don't tell. Instead of calling Goliath an incredible hulk of a man, which is an anachronistic shortcut anyway, you should show his physical reality.
Describe how he filled the entire doorframe, that his bronze armor tipped the scales at 125 pounds.
And his spear tip alone weighed as much as a shot put.
Right. It paints the picture perfectly.
And this brings us to really one of the most powerful insights in this entire deep dive. These strict rules, concrete nouns, active verbs, they aren't just for battle scenes.
No, they are the secret weapon for explaining dense, boring historical or technical data.
This is the hurdle everyone faces when communicating complex information, right? You have to give the audience background context so they understand the stakes. But the moment you start listing facts, you lose them.
Exactly. Mathewson has a hard rule about this. Never say the phrase, let me give you some background.
Because the moment you say that, the listener's brain interprets it as a commercial break.
And they instantly go to sleep.
Right. Instead, you have to take your research from the dictionaries and the atlases and weave it directly into the action.
He uses an incredible example to explain the ancient practice of Canaanite child sacrifice, drawing inspiration from James Machener's novel, The Source.
Yeah, a bad speaker would just list the dates this practice occurred. It would sound like a Wikipedia article.
But Mathewson paints a scene. He tells the listener to imagine coming home from the olive groves.
The priests tell you the stars indicate an attack, so they rub red dye from the seashore on your infant's wrists and order a burning of suns.
It translates abstract historical data into a visceral, lived experience.
You feel the grit of the olive grove. He says you have to use this exact same immersive strategy when it comes to application, too.
Preachers, or anyone trying to persuade an audience, should act like lawyers during closing arguments in a murder trial.
I love this comparison. Because during the trial, lawyers drop the boring ballistic data and bloodstain lab analysis.
Right, but in the closing argument, they simply ask the jury to act on the story of the crime.
You bridge the gap between the ancient data and the modern listener by showing what application looks like. Don't just say, be brave.
Describe Barak hesitating to fight Jabin's massive army.
And equate that to a modern listener lacking the courage to tell their kid they can't download a specific social media app on their smartphone. It's the same psychological cowardice.
Exactly.
But I can play devil's advocate here.
Right.
Aren't we shortchanging the audience if we hide the hard facts and historical background? Shouldn't the learner want the raw data about the spring runoff of the Chocolate Brown Jordan River?
Well, the data isn't missing. You aren't hiding it. It's just being delivered in a format the human brain actually retains.
Okay, so you still do the heavy archaeological research.
Oh, absolutely. But you serve it as a lived experience rather than a Wikipedia article. Narrative is the operating system of the human mind.
Right. So we have built the body of the story. But how you get listeners into it and how you get them out determines whether they remember any of it.
Entering and exiting, the introduction and the conclusion, and Matthiessen issues a massive warning right off the bat about illustrations.
Yes, the Lincoln trap.
Right. Do not interrupt a gripping ancient narrative with a long, drawn-out story about Abraham Lincoln at the Fox River.
It totally kills the momentum. You've put the listener in the damp cave with David, and then you just pop the balloon.
Exactly. If you must use an analogy, keep it to one sentence. Like comparing the confusing march around Jericho to a basketball coach telling his team, hold the ball for four quarters.
Boom. One sentence. The listener grasps the concept, and we are right back in the dust of Jericho.
Now, for entering the intro, Matthiessen leans on Haddon Robinson's classic rule.
Create interest, raise a need, and orient listeners to the text.
Right. Use a cold open or a brief quote. Like John Calvin calling the human heart an idol-making factory.
It makes the listener think, wow, I need to listen to this because it addresses a mess I struggle with.
Yes. But as vital as the intro is, exiting the conclusion is where people really stumble. You have to keep it brief and land the plane.
Right, the trap of the circling pilot. We all know the frustration of a pilot circling the airport because of air traffic.
Preachers and speakers who don't manuscript their conclusions do the exact same thing.
They taxi around again and again, coming in for a landing, but just keeping talking because they literally don't know how to stop.
It's brutal to watch.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because a bad rambling conclusion is exactly like a house guest who says, well, I should get going, but then stands in your open front door talking for 20 minutes while all the heat escapes your house.
Oh my gosh, yes. You're just begging them to leave.
Manuscripting the conclusion is like having your car keys already in hand.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the confidence to stop speaking comes from trusting that the story itself has done the heavy lifting. You don't need to circle the runway if you've already delivered the payload.
So let's summarize the key takeaways here. We started by embracing the oral style manuscript to build our blueprint.
We found the Goldilocks zone of detail and traded passive deadeners for concrete, active verbs.
We learned to disguise boring facts as vivid experiences and mastered the art of landing the plane without circling the runway.
And this applies everywhere. Whether you are leaving a meeting, sending a critical email, or just trying to hold a friend's attention, these are the master keys to human engagement.
Which leaves us with one final provocative thought to mull over. If ancient, sparse texts can be brought to vivid life just by changing went to crept and deleting passive verbs, what would happen if we applied this exact same scrutiny to the stories we tell ourselves about our own lives?
Oh, wow. That's deep.
Right. If we audited our own internal monologues and removed the passive voice changing this happened to me to active verbs, would it fundamentally change how we see ourselves as the heroes of our own stories? Something to think about.